Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, live this Sunday, March 11th, 2007. Today we have a show with one of our most popular guests ever, returning to discuss his brand new book. Our guest will be Chalmers Johnson, discussing his new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. But first, before we go to Chalmers Johnson, please join us now for Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Federal Communications Commission has reportedly reached a settlement in its investigation into radio payola. According to terms of the deal, four major broadcasters, CBS, Citadel, Clear Channel, and Entercom, will collectively pay $12.5 million in fines for allegedly engaging in practices by which record labels compensated radio stations for playing their music with cash, gifts, and trips. The four broadcasters will also reserve 1,400 hours of programming time per year for the next 3 years exclusively for independent artists. That comes out to a little less than 60 days per year split between the four. But the settlement does not require them to admit actually violating federal prohibitions against pay-for-play, violations which could have been prosecuted criminally had the FCC chosen to. Michael Bracey, the policy director for the Future of Music Coalition, says although the deal does not represent a new regulatory standard for payola in the radio industry, it may set a precedent for other broadcast companies to follow, which can only help the prospects of independent artists getting exposure in an increasingly consolidated broadcast environment.
The disastrous impact Act, the 1996 Telecommunications Act, as it has completely reshaped the radio industry, is one of the most important and most powerful ways of framing and thinking about the future debates about technology.
Put into perspective, the FCC's horse trading is not all that spectacular. The state of New York's own investigation into payola netted more than $20 million in fines against the four major record label conglomerates and another $6 million from CBS and Entercom alone. If it weren't for the New York probe, the FCC might never have looked into the payola problem. Considering the FCC's consent decree applies nationwide, the proposed penalties pale relative to the scope of the settlement. Paul Porter, co-founder of Industry Ears, a watchdog for corruption in the broadcasting and music businesses, says the FCC essentially washed its hands of payola before it even had a chance to really dig into the problem.
Nothing's changed. Nothing's going to change until either the FCC has some money to truly investigate. When you have 200 boxes of files and you haven't opened one,
the FCC is expected to vote to approve the consent decree with the four broadcast conglomerates at its monthly meeting on March 22nd.
Sometime this year, the FCC will open up a filing window for anyone interested in building their own full-power non-commercial FM radio station. According to Pete Treadish, founder of the Prometheus Radio Project, chances like this don't come along very often.
This is the first time in about 20 years that there's been a real practical opportunity to apply for a full-power non-commercial FM license.
It might very well be the last chance of its kind. The FM dial is pretty crowded. You're not likely to find an open frequency in the top 50 radio markets in the country, but travel just 20 miles outside big city limits and you may be in luck.
There are a lot of places that maybe they weren't so big 20 years ago, but now they have substantial populations and there are channels that will probably be available for them.
It'll cost between $3,000 and $8,000 to complete an engineering study of potential frequencies in your area, and you might need to hire a lawyer to help navigate the FCC's license application process, though the license itself is free. Stations can be built for as little as $20,000 and could conceivably operate on a budget as small as $25,000 a year. Public and religious broadcasters are expected to apply for many of the open channels, though Pete Treadish says any interested not-for-profit group can apply.
The costs are not that great relative to the value of the radio licenses today and the value they can produce. But it is a challenging process. It's not unlikely that you might meet with some competition on getting the license if you do find a frequency. Fortunately, the rules for that are a lot fairer than they used to be, and they do give a strong preference to local entities.
The exact date for the FCC's filing window isn't known yet. The agency will likely give just 60 to 90 days notice before they announce it.
You know, it can take a while to get the group on board. It can take a while to raise the few $1,000s for the engineering. So it's definitely a process you would want to start now if you want to be ready when the window opens, which could be as soon as May and could be as late as, say, November or so.
To search for open frequencies on the FM dial where you live and learn more about the chance to expand community radio, visit www.getradio.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We have a wonderful show today, one I've been looking forward to and one I think you're all going to enjoy listening to. Our guest joining us on the telephone from California is Chalmers Johnson, author of the brand new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. This is the third in a trilogy of books that I think many of our listeners are familiar with. The first being Blowback, the second being The Sorrows of Empire. Nemesis has just been published by Metropolitan Books. We'll be discussing it today and the provocative arguments that Chalmers Johnson makes in this book. So please sit back, listen, and enjoy the show. Chalmers Johnson, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being invited.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the air. And let's start, if we can, with the title to the book, Nemesis, and the subtitle, The Last Days of the American Republic. Why this title, and how does this book fit into your trilogy, the other two books, too?
Nemesis was the ancient Greek goddess of revenge, of the punisher of hubris and arrogance, and more or less the punisher of the kind of behavior the United States has displayed in the world since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. I chose the title because it seemed to me that's the path on which we are headed. I suspect that Nemesis is already in the country and waiting and biding her time as she observes the number of traps we are setting for ourselves. The subtitle is, I genuinely mean it. It's not just hype in order to peddle books. I don't see the way out. I can't see how any president of either party could stand up to the huge vested interests of the military-industrial complex, the secret intelligence agencies, particularly the Central Intelligence Agency, that could overcome the distortions that have already been built into our system, our growing dependence on military Keynesianism, that is, on using the defense budget as a means of propping up our economy, the virtual collapse of the separation of powers as the chief bulwark against tyranny and dictatorship in this country, numerous things of this sort, so that it's a warning. It's as strong a warning as I can do, and it follows on the other two. This was an inadvertent trilogy. I didn't set out to write the decline and fall of the American Empire in three volumes. Gibbon, after all, took six for Rome. Just one led to the other, this one comes up because of the growing crisis and the inability that we have apparently to reform. It reminds me very much of the kinds of conditions that existed in the former Soviet Union, when at least Gorbachev attempted to head off the disaster that overtook it. He failed, of course, again because of vested interests.
It's a warning bordering on a post-mortem almost, as you say, with the sort of the depressing prognosis that is in the book. Chalmers Johnson, if I could ask you just to tell a little bit to our listeners about your background, because we've had other guests on this program make a similar argument, none with your credentials, though, as a scholar on these matters. But also most of them have come from the progressive political community. They've been critics of U.S. foreign policy throughout their lives. Your background is somewhat different and gives your argument somewhat of a different perspective. Could you elaborate on that for our listeners?
Yes, of course. I'm primarily a scholar of East Asian politics, China, Japan, the two Koreas. I taught for over 30 years in the University of California, first at Berkeley, then at San Diego, and that's the primary area in which I've worked. You're quite right in saying, as I acknowledged in some detail in Blowback, that I was a cold warrior. I regarded the Soviet Union as a menace. I still do. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, I served as a consultant to the Office of National Estimates of the Central Intelligence Agency, which gave me some insight into the way this peculiar organization works, though it was entirely on the intelligence side, nothing to do with clandestine operations. One may well ask, well, okay, so what happened to you? How did you change your mind? The great English economist John Maynard Keynes, when once accused of being inconsistent, said, when I get new information, I change my position. What, sir, do you do with new information? The new information I got, without doubt, was the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 in the face of virtually all of our predictions, and which eliminated completely the raison d'etre for our huge military apparatus surrounding the world, over 700 military bases, defense budgets that threaten bankruptcy as they continue. The thing that struck me about it most of all was how extremely rapidly our government turned to the search for a replacement enemy. China, drug lords, terrorism, anything, instability if you had to do it, anything to keep the military-industrial complex funded, keep the defense industries running. Then the other thing that brought it home to me, as I say, I've spent most of my life studying East Asia, particularly Japan, but like many Japan specialists and most Japanese, I had never been to Okinawa. It's the southernmost island of Japan, a kind of Japanese version of Puerto Rico, a place that was annexed by the Japanese Empire in the late 19th century, always discriminated against, the poorest prefecture in Japan. We have 37 American military bases on an island smaller than Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands. In 1995, a very serious incident occurred in which two Marines and a sailor abducted, beat, and raped a 12-year-old girl. This set off the largest demonstrations against the United States since the security treaty had been signed. In 1996, the governor of Okinawa invited me to come and talk with him and his staff about these events and the things that had followed in their wake. I accepted and have to admit I came away shocked by the clear evidence of military imperialism. It was the closest thing to it would have been the Soviet forces in East Germany. Our troops living better in Okinawa than they would have lived in a sort of a stateside community like, say, Oceanside, California, next door to Camp Pendleton. And my first reaction was that this was exceptional. That simply nobody ever came down here. It was off the beaten track. It was a Pentagon colony, but it did not reflect much more than vested interests in the military. We had been there since the Battle of Okinawa of 1945. It was extremely hard on the Okinawans, 1,300,000 of them. The rate of sexually violent crimes committed by American troops against Okinawan women, leading to court-martial, that means unusual in Japanese culture, the woman came forward and brought charges. The rate was 2 per month, had been for 50 years. My first reaction was that this was exceptional, but it led me into a study of what is now, according to the official count, 737 American military bases in over 130 countries around the world, and I discovered that Okinawa was not exceptional, it was instead typical. These are the sort of things that set me off onto writing Blowback and The Sorrows of Empire, and then the most recent book, Nemesis.
Our guest, Chalmers Johnson, today joining us on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Our phone number for anyone wanting to call in and have a question or comment for Chalmers Johnson is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Chalmers Johnson, as he just mentioned, is the author of the brand new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. I had the privilege of reading this book over the past week, and I've read all your books, all of the trilogy, I should say.
Thank you.
Professor Johnson, and I will be assigning this book to my 600-student undergraduate course on media and society this fall, you'll be glad to know.
Yeah.
It is a book I wish all Americans would read because you do a very nice, this is an original book. It is not just a rehash of the last two. You do a very nice job in the book discussing, I think, the notion of empire, the relationship of empire democracy. And I'd like you to take a second now, if you would, and talk a little bit about the founders and Madison and their concerns about militarism and how that relates to constitutional rule, and then what the problems are today.
Well, the essential argument of Nemesis is that history tells us, philosophy tells us, our founders tell us, that there is no more unstable configuration politically than the one that exists in the United States today, namely domestic democracy and foreign empire. You can have one or you can have the other, but you can't have both. They're hopelessly unstable for reasons I'll explain in just a minute, and they will end up with either you're losing your domestic democracy and becoming a tyranny, as did the Roman Republic, on which much of our constitutional system was modeled, numerous precedents that we took from the old Roman Republic, which after the assassination of Julius Caesar turned into a military dictatorship, and democracy did not return for well over 1,000 years. Or you could, as I suggest in the book, and I believe we should be debating in America much more vigorously, you could abandon your empire in order to keep your democracy, and offer, as an example, the British after World War II, when it came home to them after the victory over Nazism. They could not continue to hold on to the jewel in the crown of their empire, namely India, through administrative massacres, which is the device they had used to rule the subcontinent, and that the British public wouldn't tolerate it. It would require that Britain become a tyranny. They gave it up, didn't do a very good job of it. There were many throwbacks as time passed, severe colonial wars, utter repressive wars against the Kikuyu in Kenya in the 1950s, the Anglo-British Israeli attempted invasion of Egypt in 1956. For an atavism, you couldn't do much better than look right today at Tony Blair, who seems... It seems almost unbelievable that any English leader would lead Britain back into the hellhole they created after the First World War, namely Iraq, out of former prefectures of the Ottoman Empire. But he certainly did, and he's paid the price in the sense that Britain simply has lost influence in the world, as has the United States. But the connecting link here, the intervening variable, as the social scientists would say, is militarism. The maintenance of an empire, no matter how you acquired it, it requires a standing army. It requires military force in order to acquire it in the first place, to protect it, to expand it, to police it. And this leads us back to probably the earliest and most important warning ever made about our constitutional system, and that was in George Washington's farewell address, read at the opening of every new session of Congress, in which he warned that the great enemy of liberty is standing armies, the particular fatal enemy of Republican liberty. What he meant by this is that standing armies draw power to Washington, D.C. They conflict with federalism in the sense of the government, the federal government and the state governments, that they produce vested interests in the military. They increase radically the power of the presidency and his the president's power to to invoke secrecy over everything that he does, things of this sort, and that the fatal consequence is to destroy the balance of power built into the Constitution, a very Roman device, so that, well, I mean, our president now goes around prattling on about he's the decider. It's hard to think of anything more anti-constitutional than that remark. He is anything but the decider. The decisions of this sort are made collegially in our country, and different branches of the government are supposed to agree with each other through compromise and negotiation, rather than through a fiat and dictatorship. Over time, empire inevitably requires militarism. It's the same warning, of course, that Dwight Eisenhower made in 1961 when he left office, a warning about uncontrolled power in the military-industrial complex, the dangers of our becoming dependent upon an arms industry, the vicious cycle it sets up between arms being out there and leading to wars, because wars then lead to more arms, and the cycle goes up to the point where today we have defense budgets that are larger than all other defense budgets on Earth combined, and are flirting with bankruptcy. This is the essential issue that I believe we're talking about. We understand these issues. We've been warned, and yet our public is inattentive. That being the case, I believe we may be talking about the short, happy life of the American Republic. Empires go down quite rapidly these days. I'm 75 years old. I've seen in my lifetime the end of the Nazi, Imperial Japanese, British, French, Dutch, Portuguese, Soviet empires. That's a lot of them. Ours is not immune, particularly when we are the world's largest debtor nation, when we're living off the kindness of others, particularly Chinese and Japanese, and don't manufacture much in this country anymore except for weapons and munitions. These are just a few of the things I try to detail and combine into a coherent pattern in this new book. Hello?
This is Chalmers Johnson.
Yes.
Who is here on Media Matters. I am Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580. Professor Johnson is the author of the new book, Nemesis. The phone lines here for people who'd like to call in with questions or comments for Chalmers Johnson, 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Professor Johnson, you go in some detail in the book on precisely what the Bush administration has been doing to violate international law.
Yes.
And what the constitutional implications of that are for a republic. This was one of the first chapters in the book. It was quite, it was stuff I knew about for the most part, but still, when you put it all together, it was quite a dossier.
What I'm trying to say, that is the truth, that we get sort of piecemeal stuff from the New York Times occasionally, but the public has not been warned by our leaders of the of what we're in danger of losing.
Could you talk a little bit about the torture scandal, and specifically which you go through in the book in quite some detail?
Well, precisely. It's hard to think of anything more grotesque than having the senior leaders of our country order torture of defenseless prisoners. I've just recently been making a visit and giving a talk at University of California, Berkeley. In the library there right now are Francisco Botero's Abu Ghraib paintings that are on exhibit. They have not found a museum that was courageous enough to take them, but the Center for Latin American Studies at Berkeley has put them on display. They're truly shocking. Essentially, what I'm dwelling on in Nemesis is the ease with which our government started saying things like the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of prisoners of war or civilians in wartime are obsolete, are out of date, that we don't need to pay attention to them. This is absurd. The Constitution is quite explicit that a ratified treaty, and after all, we sponsored these treaties, we ratified them, We have long abided by them because they serve our interests, too, in protecting our own troops. That when Mr. Gonzalez or John Yoo or other supporters of the employees of the personal servants of the president start saying that the Geneva treaties are obsolete, they have no authority to say that. The Secretary of Defense, the president, has no authority to up and declare a ratified treaty as no longer relevant. It's hard to imagine greater damage done to the United States than the photographs that were released from Abu Ghraib. Now, I do something in the book that I realize some people dislike intensely, namely any comparison of anything the United States ever does with Nazi Germany leads to charges that one is being extreme, gone too far, etc. But what I have in mind here is at the time of the Abu Ghraib pictures were released, there was rumors around the Pentagon, pictures of six enlisted men and women with signs written under them, the six morons that lost the war in Iraq. I decided instead it was not six, but at least seven morons. They started with the president and went down through Donald Rumsfeld, General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, the commandant in Iraq, the commandant at Guantanamo Bay, John Warner, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, in which they seem to be behaving in the way Hannah Arendt described Adolf Eichmann in her famous book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, that in reporting on Eichmann's trial, she you will recall that in the last line of her book, she used the now famous line after his execution, this is a portrait of the banality of evil. She didn't explain what she meant by the banality of evil and later said that she didn't mean something theoretically sophisticated. But she was under a lot of pressure to explain it, go further, and in later in life she explained that what struck her about Eichmann was that he was extremely well-educated, knowledgeable, a desk murderer, as she called him, pretty good phrase for some of our characters, he'd forgotten how to think, that he was simply living inside a cocoon of bureaucracy, and that he was a functionary. He was charged with simply supplying the transport for thousands of Jewish prisoners across Europe to the death camps. It struck me that the people in Abu Ghraib and the people who ordered it and who thought about it and who justified it legal sophistry had forgotten how to think. And it was drawn to my attention by the thought that there was at least one of them who hadn't forgotten how to think. That was Sergeant Darby, who in the prison also had a computer cassette with a large number of pictures of people being tortured with dogs and one thing after another. But he said, this is contrary to everything I stand for, that the Army stands for, that my country stands for, and he sent it to the Army's Criminal Investigation Division. It struck my mind that Sergeant Darby, who has, after all, been also persecuted rather seriously for having done so, was one of the few Americans who had not forgotten how to think. It's also worth remembering that Americans in general could claim that they were not responsible for the Bush administration's policies in the first term, because after all, Bush had not won the election. He had been appointed by a 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court. But in 2004, in the presidential election, he won the popular vote by well over 3.5 million ballots, and that occurred after Abu Ghraib. That made his wars, his actions, his orders, his way of doing things ours in the minds of the rest of the world. This is something that I find it unlikely that the United States will ever live down, any more than, say, the Japanese are ever going to live down the whole scandal of seizing young women in occupied countries during World War II and impressing them as frontline prostitutes for their troops, the so-called comfort women, probably as obscene a euphemism as I can think of. I think that we are caught in that right now, and we don't know it, but it's going to come back to haunt us. Hello?
We have a few callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Chalmers Johnson. Yes, line one?
Hello?
Yes,
hello?
You're on the air with Chalmers Johnson, line one.
I'm extremely impressed by your general line of argument. One thing, though, I noticed that you while you're rather harsh on our government, you don't seem to lay much on the American people themselves. It seems to me that a democracy is by definition where the people lead and the government executes the will of the people or public opinion. Well, you pointed out that Mr. Bush thinks that you know that he's a great decider.
Yes.
Yes, indeed he does. The only thing is, the American people, with him gone after making a mess of things, they'll lust after another great decider.
Well, well said.
They won't go back to something like a coherent public opinion or where the people think. The typical Americano is not a political thinker. He's a television watcher, a sports fan, and a beer guzzler. So the idea that you have this great democratic...
Well, let me stop you there and talk about it a little bit, because, yeah, of course, I agree with you. It's at the very heart of the problem. Do the American people play the role of citizen as envisaged by, for example, Benjamin Franklin?
Right.
Are they capable, do they have the information, to do elementary oversight on their own government? The problems, it seems to me, here are numerous. That on the one hand, they're ill-informed. The media don't perform the role that the people who drafted Article 1 of the Constitution have in mind. I mean, they did not write freedom of the press in there in order to protect People magazine. It was written in there quite explicitly so that the free press, its function would be to penetrate the official state bureaucracy and expose it to daylight so that citizens could know what was going on. As it stands right now, contrary to the Constitution, 40% of the defense budget remains black and has been since World War II. All of the defense budget, of the intelligence budget, particularly the Central Intelligence Agency, from the day in which it was created, remains secret, turning the CIA essentially into a private army of the president's, with today only minimal oversight until the church committees of the late 1970s, no oversight whatsoever. It was entirely the president's plaything. So that it's very, very difficult for the public to be well-informed, to play an effective role. At the same time, the system itself is also failing us. The public, I'd say in America, at least my impression, now that I've begun to try and promote this third book in lectures at universities and bookstores and things of this sort, the public seems more alarmed than they were after the first two books, worried. They have a sinking sensation that we are beginning to move very close to what happened to the USSR in the late 1980s, and that therefore we had an election last November. They turn power over to the opposition party. We have in this country, in the Constitution, a perfectly good system for getting rid of unsatisfactory political leaders. It's called impeachment. The first statement that Mrs. Pelosi made was that impeachment is off the table. Well, if impeachment is off the table, I think it's very possible that the Republic is off the table, too. We have to do... that is the only way you could possibly save the system right now, is to reconstitute the constitutional system. Now, that's going to require something like dismantling the military-industrial complex, that is, cutting our overseas bases from, say, 737 down to at least 37. I'm not sure we need those. But We ought to be rid of 700 of them. Right now, they're worthless, expensive, and provide absolutely nothing in the way of security. What they provide is an empire for us. We're going to have to dismantle the secret intelligence agencies and return intelligence collecting and gathering and putting into some form that leaders can use to an agency like the old intelligence agency of the State Department, which has also outperformed these other agencies numerous times over. These are changes that I say are so great and will so and have such wrenching consequences that it's not easy to contemplate them. I mean, I live in the 50th District of California. That's in northern San Diego County. Our Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham is now sitting in a federal prison for 8.5 years as the worst bribee in the history of the U.S. Congress. And it's worth, of course, remembering that though he claimed to be a war hero from Vietnam as an ace Navy pilot, he was being bribed by defense contractors. In our wisdom, we have put Cunningham in prison and elected a lobbyist in his to replace him, which presumably means somebody just a little bit smarter than he is when it comes to taking bribes. This is not a favorable prognosis, and I agree with you. That is, one of the things that needs to be done is to catch the attention of inattentive citizens. That's what we're attempting to do on this radio program this morning. It's morning here in California.
Afternoon here in the Midwest, Professor Johnson. Right. Our guest, Professor Chalmers Johnson, author of the brand new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We have several very patient callers who I want to get to in 1 second. But before we get back to them, Professor Johnson, I do want to ask you about a line of inquiry that you raise in the book and that as often comes up, which is the idea that the United States is not an empire in the sense of Rome or even the British, although we're closer to the British, but we're a humanitarian empire, that we are doing what we do because of our what's good for America is good for the world, because we, by our definition, are promoting human rights, the rights of women, the rights of protecting people from genocide, and that if we weren't doing that globally, the world would be a much, much worse place, not just for American interests, but for the interests of women and poor people and humanity.
Every empire makes these kinds of claims. It's a peculiar disease of the Anglo-American mind to always believe that our motives are pure. Imperialism is a pure form of tyranny. It never rules through consent. Just glance at Iraq if you doubt that, that it may claim that its actions are beneficent, but that is never the way it is seen by people on the receiving end. It is only something that it's a cottage industry of the English to tell you how wonderful the British Empire actually was without ever mentioning the endless massacres, the economic deprivation, the war crimes committed by the British in numerous cases, the Amritsar massacre. General Dyer quit firing at innocent Punjabis only when he ran out of ammunition. And there are 1,001 cases of this sort. I think the point to stress is that there's also some confusion that how can we have an empire when we don't have colonies? Colonies are not the defining definition of empire, but there is no doubt the British, French, Dutch, Japanese did have colonies and used them as devices for maintenance of their empire. The kind of empire I have in mind is much more like that of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, where it established after World War II a system of satellites from Bulgaria to Germany were dominated by the Red Army, either located in the territory or on its immediate borders, that dictated governments that were subservient to Moscow and tried to integrate the territory into the Soviet economic bloc. That's the kind of empire we have. As I say, it's made up of 737, that's the official count in the base structure report, which is an annual inventory of property we own around the world by the Pentagon. It's not particularly accurate. It omits all sorts of things that are embarrassing to the United States. So it's at least 737. These are real military bases, too. Some defenders of the Pentagon like to try and say, oh, you're counting Marine Corps guards in American embassies. I guarantee you we don't have anywhere near 700 embassies around the world. There aren't that many countries. No, these are all genuine American armed forces. Maybe, you may say, as our president does, they're spreading democracy. Well, they're spreading democracy at the point of an assault rifle. The most common picture we get from of our heroes in Iraq is of half a dozen burly men, one of them kicking down the door of a private home, roaring inside and confronting cowering women with, as I say, assault rifles, and hollering democracy at them in a language they don't understand. There are, at the time of the invasion, there were four Arabic speakers in the U.S. Army. It's that bad a situation, and that incompetent a situation.
Professor Johnson, if I can interrupt for one second, you've mentioned several times now that we have, the United States has 733 bases in other countries.
737.
Yeah. 737, plus others you talk about in the book,
right.
Making us the number one country in the world in that regard. Who's number two, and how many bases do they have outside their borders?
I'm not absolutely certain. It may very well be Britain. It could be Japan, which has in the 90s. Germany's numbers have been going down largely because of the attempt by Rumsfeld to punish them for...
But does any other country have like 50 or 100 or 75 bases?
Oh, sure. I mean, South Korea's got close to 100.
Outside its borders? No, I'm talking about...
Other countries. Other countries. No other countries have military bases outside of their borders, with the possible exception of Great Britain, if you want to count Gibraltar.
So basically, we're the only one playing in this game.
We have no understanding of this at all, either, because we have no foreign military bases in the United States. We don't understand the bar brawls, the bordellos, the drunken driving, the hit-and-run driving, the noise, environmental pollution that you just simply live with if you've got American military bases, such as those, say, in Northern Italy today, at Vicenza or Aviano or places like that, which are right now seriously protesting the continued presence of foreign troops in Italian soil years after, half a century after World War II, and with the Americans thinking with impunity they could commit felonies in Italy and get away with it. As you know, we now have... There are well over 20 CIA officers that have been indicted for kidnapping and rendition in Italy. They've all been spirited out of the country, but these were CIA activities that they basically mean kidnapping people off the streets of foreign countries and transporting them to either CIA prisons or to other countries where they know they will be tortured. As the CIA has commonly said, if you want a interrogation under torture, you send them to Jordan. If you just want them to disappear, you send them to Egypt.
Our guest, Chalmers Johnson, and Professor Johnson is the author of the new book, Nemesis. I've been hogging the lines. We have three callers I'm going to get to in a moment. I just want to let our listeners know that I've only asked like the first two of maybe 15 questions I have from this book. This book includes a great deal more material about the United States, the state of our democracy, the sorry state, according to Professor Johnson, and a number of issues related to our militarism and our global empire that we haven't gotten to in the program yet. So there's a lot more to this book. Let's go back to the phone lines right now if we can. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with Professor Johnson, and thank you very much for your patience.
You mentioned Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
Can you verify that he did or did not originally say military-industrial-congressional complex?
He didn't say that. That's the way he drafted it.
Okay, right. He said it in private.
Pardon? Yes. He was warned off by, of course, Congress. And it's an extremely interesting statement because it is so strident. It's so undiplomatic. It's couched in extremely strong
an alarmist
language. How can I quote that? Where can I look that up so I can cite it with some authority?
I don't have the citation right in front of me, but you can find it in many places. Try Googling it under Eisenhower.
Yeah, I did that. I couldn't find anybody that was as reliable as yourself.
Well, thank you very much. But it you may know of the film that I appeared in called Why We Fight, made by Eugene Jarecki.
Yes.
You might try giving Jarecki a call. He's a bit more of an admirer of Eisenhower than I am. I mean, Eisenhower was, after all, the butcher of Guatemala.
How would I reach him?
I don't have his phone number in front of me.
I'd try Google again.
But I'm sure that you
I'm Googling
it
right now as I speak.
Okay, well, thank you very much, sure. Line 2. Let's go back to the phone lines for yet another patient caller. This one from Mattoon. Line 4, you're on the air with Chalmers Johnson.
Had a couple of questions. I think you've answered part of it, but I understand that we have troops stationed in 40-plus countries. Around,
over 130, actually.
Pardon?
Over 130, actually.
130 countries?
Yes.
And a number of them are in these new countries in South Russia that border a pipeline that goes from oil fields down to Turkey.
Right.
And I was wondering, I've also heard that this coalition of the willing, a lot of these little countries that send a number of troops, that we subsidized.
Yes.
Or bought them off. Is there any truth to that?
Absolutely. We do it through various devices. Foreign military sales is done through the State Department. We supply military aid. Our troops invariably spend their time training local troops. It's a sort of training that they don't need. Often, I'm sorry to say, training in state terrorism in many cases. But there's no question that we have... We are using our military today as our diplomatic arm. Our foreigners who encounter Americans encounter them, first of all, in a camouflage uniform, khaki-colored, and that they are young 18 to 24-year-old, usually men, who don't know where they are, don't know anything about the world, have a lot of built-in racism as a result of their education as they work through the military system. They are not a citizen army. Service in our armed forces is not an obligation of citizenship. It has not been since 1973. It's a career choice for the people who do it. They are, I believe, not the representatives of the United States that most of us would like or envision under our constitutional system.
Our guest, Chalmers Johnson, author of the new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. We do have time for a couple more callers if people want to call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 3, Champaign County, you're on the air with Chalmers Johnson.
Hi. Your remark about Eisenhower being the butcher of Guatemala sort of makes my question about your phrase at the beginning that you attributed a lot of this to our actions since the end of the Cold War. It seems that you acknowledge that this has been a strain in U.S. history. Maybe 1898 might be a better start in some regards. So I just wanted to clarify that because in your opening remarks you were saying that it was sort of the end of the Cold War sort of prompted revulsion against...
Well, let me explain. Of course, you're right. Fair enough. I mean, you could, in many ways, take it back to the founding of the Republic itself. I mean, after all, it was Theodore Roosevelt who said, of course, we are not imperialists. We have an imperialist bone in our body. We are expansionists. We all believe in expansionism. We've been engaged in that kind of distinction for years. What I had in mind, and certainly my book, Blowback, that was published before 9/11, was an attempt to say that the foreign policy problems of the 21st century will be left over blowback, that is, retaliation, for actions that we committed during the Cold War. Blowback is a CIA term. It was first used in the first clandestine overthrow of a foreign democratically elected government in its after-action report. That was the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953 for the sake of the British Petroleum Company. The The authors, it was just recently declassified, the authors say that we're going to get some blowback from it. Blowback means retaliation for things that our government has done abroad, but it also means something else. It means retaliation for things our government has done abroad that were kept totally secret from the American public, so that when the retaliation comes, the public cannot put it in context, cannot see cause and effect. The classic example is, of course, 9/11, which was blowback for the largest clandestine operation we ever carried out, namely the arming, training, sending into battle of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And then once the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan in 1988, our simply dumping them, allowing Afghanistan to descend into one of the most horrific civil wars in modern times, in which the public came to welcome and applaud the coming to power of the Taliban as preferable to what actually existed. So there is no question that our record here goes back to the... I mean, on the morning of 9/11, I was chatting with my publisher before it was clear that this was a terrorist incident, but it wasn't clear yet who were the terrorists, and we hadn't thought that they were Islamic or Saudi Arabian or anything of that sort. Our first thought was, well, it's the date, September 11th. Everyone in Latin America knows it's September 11th, 1973, is when the CIA overthrew the elected government of Chile, of Salvador Allende, and installed in his place as our puppet, probably the most odious figure installed by either side throughout the Cold War, General Augusto Pinochet, who remained in power well into the 1990s. We were thinking it could have been Greeks. Greece is probably the most anti-American democracy on earth. It will never forgive us for the reign of the Greek colonels of 1967 to 1973, when they themselves just simply went too far and self-destructed. It could have been Indonesians. We've, after all, overthrew the government of President Sukarno. Then we overthrew the government of General Suharto, the guy we put in power, when he got on our nerves, the sort of thing that we've done over and over again. As we declare, as the current president declares, we have a right to engage in preventive war, regime change, axes of evil, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason for stressing the end of the Cold War and the things that have happened since then, that's really where nemesis comes into play. The hubris becomes overwhelming. We declared that we won the Cold War. We didn't win the Cold War. Both sides lost it. They lost it first because they were always poorer than we are. But we're both now beginning to suffer. That is, we are suffering from the same things that they were: imperial overstretch, extreme economic ideological rigidity, inability to reform, and are heading in the same direction. But we emerged from the Cold War with phrases like, we are the lone superpower, we are a new Rome, we're beyond good and evil, we can dominate the world through military power, we are seeking full-spectrum dominance, an almost obscene term, which means into outer space. I have a chapter on that in Nemesis. That sort of thing that I think is when the hubris began to show up and the Americans quit paying attention.
Professor Johnson, our guest, Chalmers Johnson, author of Nemesis. We have two callers waiting patiently. Let's try to get them and let them make very brief.
And let me speak.
Well, you're doing great, Professor Johnson. Yeah, perhaps.
I beg your pardon.
Let's go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Chalmers Johnson.
Hi, I wanted to say I really appreciate your books a lot, and your voice is very fresh and much needed, but I'm wondering, how are you received by mainstream political scientists and other academics?
And if I can add to that, Professor Johnson, perhaps you could talk about how you're received by mainstream news media, cable TV shows, and that like as well.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the New York Times has declared that it's not going to review Nemesis, that I think it's decided that my colleague and a man I greatly admire, Noam Chomsky, and I are both beyond the pale. They're not going to touch it. I don't like that. I think it's unfair. You write a book, I expect, to have the media play their role, but then we're now used to saying the media simply don't play the role, that they keep complaining they want to press freedom, they don't use it well, and we're in serious trouble. People get their news from television. These are owned by conglomerates that do this for purposes of advertising revenue. They're as incompetent as one can imagine. Rupert Murdoch is talking about buying a third of the Los Angeles Times. It's difficult to keep well informed. As for how I'm received by my academic colleagues, I was chairman of political science at Berkeley. I was chairman of the Center for Chinese Studies. I had a good and successful academic career. I retired in 1992. That's a long time ago. There is, I must say, life after the big organization. I no longer have to pretend that my colleagues are smart. I personally believe that the universities have failed us badly, in particularly political science and economics, in engaging in a sort of mesmerizing internal argument, which they call theoretically sophisticated. It's mostly nonsense driven by mathematics and lust for the Nobel Prize and a few other things of this sort, so that we simply haven't had informed comment on, say, a thing like the war in Iraq from our academics. I shouldn't doubt that there are academics who can control their enthusiasm for me, but I have one of the things I am trying to do, however, as a 75-year-old retired professor, is open up some subjects like imperialism and militarism for academic research for some good PhD dissertations, because right now they're a little too delicate for a young person to take on. They know full well that they can be squelched by the establishment. I've had well over 40 PhD students that I supervised at Berkeley. Many of them are close friends of mine today. They say to me, look, you're invulnerable. If you won't speak out, don't expect us to. We've got to establish some space here so that a guy can teach about imperialism and militarism, and if his dean or the trustees start falling in on him, he can say, look, I'm just talking about Johnson's book. It's don't blame me.
Professor Johnson, let's go to our last caller, and hopefully it's a true-false question.
Yes.
Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Chalmers Johnson.
Yeah, very brief question. You predicted the decline of the U.S. empire. What form do you think it will take?
I believe it will take the form of bankruptcy. I don't expect a military takeover as in the Roman Republic, even though it's not inconceivable. General Tommy Franks, the leader of the assault on Baghdad, has already promised it in case of another 9/11 in America. I do not really expect a renaissance of American democracy from below, though I continue to behave as if I thought it were possible. But I believe that we will therefore maintain the facade of constitutional government and stagger on until, like, Germany in 1923, China in 1948, Argentina in 2001 and 2002, our economy will collapse. We are easily the world's largest debtor nation.
Professor Johnson, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means it's time for me to clear out of the studio. I want to thank our guest today, Professor Chalmers Johnson, author of the new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, for joining us on Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my tremendous producer, the whole staff at WILL, Norm Stockwell at WORT in Madison, who's been instrumental in making this program work the last few weeks. I'll be back in 167 hours with Michael Albert. Until then, have a good week, everyone.